Good afternoon. I think that we are all assembled. Before I call the case, we are going to do a little review of how we keep time when we do oral arguments by Zoom. If counsel will look to the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you will see a green card that says start when it's time for you to begin, and I will also tell you it's time to begin. When you have 5 minutes left, there will be a yellow five-minute card, and when it's time to conclude, you will see a red stop sign. I will pretty much hold you to the red sign and help you notice it, because I know sometimes when you get involved in argument, it's kind of, that's what you need to be thinking about, not about what color the cards are that are flipping up there. However, if you are answering the question of a justice and the red stop card comes up, I want you to finish answering the question. So you just go ahead and finish the answer. With those little preliminaries out of the way, are you both prepared to proceed?
I am, Chief Justice.
Okay, then I will call our third case for the day, State versus Birch. Attorney Babcock, will you begin?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Anna Babcock, and I represent the defendant appellant, George Birch. This case involves three separate and distinct constitutional events, each of which violated Mr. Birch's Fourth Amendment rights, and each of which provide an independent avenue for relief. It has become common in police investigations for police to look at cell phones. It might be to see if someone called their drug supplier. It could be the anecdote in the LAW's amicus brief, where they want to look at the victim's text messages to see if she did indeed invite her assailant over or not. And the general practice is police hand the individual this generic broad form that says, search my phone. Individual signs off on it. They take the phone down to the police department, hook it up to the equipment, and then extract every bit of data from that. Now, the issue in this case is, what can police do with that? I'll show you, it gets dispersed in discovery. On this drive, I have the cell phone extractions of about a dozen individuals associated with this case. Some are suspect. Most of them are bystanders or friends, people collaterally involved. But I also have the victim's sister and her mother's full cell phone extractions that were handed over through the discovery process. And in storage in my office, I have hundreds, if not thousands more of these extractions. I have at my fingertips literally every intimate detail of so many people's lives. I know what their kids look like. I know where their kids go to school. For many, I know what their genitalia looks like. And at the conclusion of my representation, it's my understanding that this is part of the file, and that file belongs to the client. And I don't know of any rules or regulations that limits what he can do with this data and who he can share it with. So I think that there is a legitimate concern that the government, if it hasn't done so already, will create a database of these millions of extractions floating around to use at its investigative leisure. I also think it's equally possible that savvy criminal enterprises could create such a database to use for its purposes. Now, in this case, it's very clear that consent was limited. That is confirmed by the testimony of the officer, the purpose of the search, and the historical findings of fact by the circuit court. The exact testimony of the officer, this is at Appendix 109, is I asked him if I could see the text messages between him and Jordan, if my lieutenant and I could take a look at his text messages. Birch says yes. And then the officer testifies that, doing a manual search of a phone is pretty cumbersome. You have to take individual screenshots and then you got to scan it and put it into report. So it's just easier if we hook it up to the machine and then we download the information that way. So he asks Birch if he would be willing to let me take his phone to this detective, download the information off the phone. Won't take more than 30 minutes or so. Now, the trial court, in its findings, did specifically indicate that initially consent was limited to just text messages. But where the court erred is in concluding that consent was broadly expanded when Birch consented to the download of the information. So in this court has said in Reed that consent must be specific, and it's going to take a lot more specificity to get from a very narrow conversation about text messages to suddenly downloading every single bit of data on the phone. I mean, otherwise that's like the classic bait and switch deception that the Lemons court denounced and was concerned with. Moving on to the second constitutional violation, the retention of the data. This is probably one of the more complex issues, and I've segregated it out into two different categories, the responsive irrelevant information and the non-responsive irrelevant. And I'm going to concede a point that I was too stubborn to do in the briefing process. And that was this bright line rule that I proposed with regard to like the relevant and the responsive data. I got that from the McCavitt case, but in mooting this, this case, it became quite clear how unworkable that is. So the state is completely correct. We should not have a bright line rule, and instead the totality of the circumstances test really applies here. Okay.
Can I ask a question too? I don't know if you'll concede this one or not.
Okay.
I found, I believe there's a lot of case law out there that an email address is not something you have a right of privacy in. And when we're talking about this case, and I will let you continue on about retention. I think there's so many issues in this case, but at the end of the day, the location data that was used by Brown County after getting a warrant or something, and maybe you can address that too, what they got for that. But it appears they got a separate warrant for the location data, but they did that based on an email address. And does your client have, even if this was done improperly and we could say all kinds of things about retention and even consent and cell phones, does your client have a privacy interest in the email address which led to the actual information used at trial? How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, Justice Dallet, as in terms of the email address, the right to privacy here is what is on the phone, the contents of the phone. And to use an analogy, let's say that police illegally entered someone's home and they're rifling through their bureau and they find a business card with an email address. I don't think that that would be limited because it's the search into the phone that really constitutes the invasion of privacy. And remember that it wasn't just the email address that they found. They also found this internet browsing history.
Right. So let's set the history aside. You got a good argument about that. Let's go back to the email address. Does it have a privacy interest or not? Because if you don't have a privacy interest, as bad as it may have been to have downloaded all this material, at the end of the day, what was actually used may be separate and apart from that because there's no privacy interest.
Well, I think that it needs to stop at the entire contents of the phone, because that's a really slippery slope. You know, like, do you have a privacy interest in a picture of your child that you shared on Facebook that's found in the phone? It's the entry into the phone where the real violation occurs, regardless of whether, you know, this is something that you independently have a privacy interest in. And so now going to that, the retention issue and with the responsive and relevant data. Okay. So I got that bright rule from McCavitt, and it doesn't really work because it's going to be different in every circumstance. You know, in McCavitt, the purge trigger was after he was acquitted. In some cases that go cold or that, you know, evidence is trickling in, maybe it's the statute of limitations. But in this case, and I know that we had this argument about whether the hit and run case was closed. I don't have to win that. I don't even need to go there because the only information that remained was that report that the tech had generated that segregated out those text messages. So the real critical point here that we're looking at is after police extracted all of the data, and then took the stuff that they really wanted to get and put it into a separate report. what basis did the government have for maintaining this entire extraction? And it's at that point that a potentially legal, lawful seizure, you know, the over-seizure of data is tolerated. I don't think it really was in this case because the tech testified that she could download just the text messages. But even if it was, once that material is downloaded, the government, or excuse me, is downloaded and the relevant stuff is segregated, the government has no legitimate interest in the rest of that data. And an individual's privacy and possessory interests must prevail in that circumstance.
Counsel, I want to just explore that a little bit further. The cases, you cited mostly to do with sort of a warrant. And I guess I want to explore this a little bit further. So suppose for a minute that, I told law enforcement, you can take pictures of my car. Any part of my car, anything that's in my car, anything in my glove compartment. Okay. Does law enforcement have a duty to get rid of that information under the Fourth Amendment? I'm trying to figure out like where we get the broad idea that government has to dispose of information when there's been consent given to give that information to law enforcement. And I guess I'm not understanding where your line would be. So maybe you could help me with that. So my picture example, how would you answer that?
Okay. So taking the pictures of the car, and I guess I should start with, you know, this case involves cell phones, which are special because they hold so much information.
And I just want to clarify, part of the reason I'm giving that is because I want to move us. I understand there's a particular context for cell phones, but I want you to assume for these purposes that we don't have a scope of consent problem. Okay, there's actually been consent because, as you pointed out, your argument is that this retention issue is a separate independent ground. So I just want to isolate that point, assume we don't have a consent problem.
Okay, so taking pictures of the car, and, you know, it would kind of depend on what context that was done. That doesn't necessarily. Okay, so they take pictures of the car and then they put those into evidence, and that's, I'm assuming that these pictures are relevant to something. So at that point, that's when that balancing test comes in, and we weigh, you know, how long the government has an interest in that data against any privacy interests that individual may have, which I don't think are that much, certainly not as much as are at issue with a cell phone.
If I'm hearing you correctly, your argument is that every law enforcement agency, when they gather evidence in the course of an investigation where there's been consent to give that evidence, that they have to then go through some balancing test to determine how long they need to keep it before deleting their computer files or throwing away their folders. Is that the argument that you're presenting?
I mean, in essence, and I think a lot of times common sense will dictate, if a defendant was acquitted, what basis do police have to keep that information?
So what about a blood test with OWI? Does law enforcement have a duty to get rid of blood test information, assuming there's been consent to give the blood draw? They need to delete that evidence? And relatedly, is the DNA... The DNA database that the state maintains, is that unlawful under your argument?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because there's so much crossover between cell phones and DNA and blood. At a certain point, that blood test does need to be destroyed. Now, I know that they have to keep it for, you know, a certain period of time. I think it's even in the statutes, so the defense can have access to testing it. But at a certain point, once they no longer have an interest in it, in that case, you know, say they got a conviction and direct appeal rights have expired, I don't think that they have any basis to retain that. And that was very interesting. This court's decision in Randall, the court was very clear that the only thing that could be tested or used that they could test in her blood was the blood alcohol concentration. And that if the testing went beyond that, say for genetic information, pregnancy, family medical history, that would not be legal.
So just to make sure I understand your argument, your argument is that the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution renders retention of any evidence that was gathered pursuant to the consent of someone in the course of an investigation, once some balancing test turns out that the government doesn't have as much interest in it. And that means, I hear you saying, that possibly the state's DNA database is unconstitutional in part for retention of data for an extended period of time.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the DNA database because there's a different framework within which that is kind of set up. But keep in mind, so I don't have to win this retention argument. I think it's the most difficult conceptually to, you know, kind of figure out what these rules are and how they look like. But I think this court should make very clear that if police want to do a new search, that they need to have a warrant. Even if this court lets them retain that, you've got to have a warrant. In Randall, you would have had to have had a warrant to test that Jessica Randall's blood beyond the blood alcohol concentration.
And that's your third issue, right? That's different than the retention issue. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding you.
Yeah, there's lots to unpack here.
That's fine. I'll let you move on to other issues. I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, yeah. Now that you've set forth, at least in summary fashion, the three main constitutional occurrences, challenges, I note that in looking at the certification of the Court of Appeals, I saw with regard to the retention issue, 7 or 8 sub-questions. The same thing with regard to the new search and the same thing with regard to the scope. So this case has lots of tentacles. Give to me what is the narrowest, best argument on which you should win.
That is consent. I think it's unequivocal that consent was specifically limited to text messages. And I mean, the court doesn't need to go any further than that. I certainly would like it to, because, you know, this is something that's going to reoccur and come up. These cell phone extractions, full extractions are so common, and they're kind of passed out like candy. So I think it's something that is important for this court to at least rule on. And if it doesn't want to go the retention route, which I could see, you know, why that those tentacles are a little bit difficult. But the new search, right, requiring a new warrant. If police want to go and search Randall's blood for genetic history, they've got to get a warrant. If they want to look at the cell phone extraction in connection with a new investigation, they've got to get a warrant. And there was a case out of Michigan that was, I found out about it after my brief was finished, but not filed. And that addresses cell phones in the context of warrants, and essentially holds that if you want to search a cell phone for different crimes or a cell phone extraction, you need a new warrant.
Also, was there a new warrant here? Because it seemed a little bit unclear. It looked like the sheriff's department got a warrant. Did they get a warrant to look at the information?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I think that's a question for my friend, Attorney O'Neill. But so all the testimony at the suppression hearing was that Sergeant Lopp now testified that we looked at it. We didn't have a warrant. We didn't need a warrant because it was in our possession. And the circuit court found there was some like reference to a warrant at some point by the district attorney, but there's no warrant in the file. I'm aware of none. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know when this warrant would have been issued. Like if it was issued after they already looked at did the illegal search, that's kind of meaningless.
So counsel, I want to follow up on this needing a new warrant piece here. So again, let's assume that we have clear consent that's given, and let's assume that we don't have a retention problem. Just for the moment, I want to just isolate this third issue that you've identified. So it would be your position that if, for example, I went to the hospital and got a blood test, and let's say I got a whole bunch of things tested, and I gave that voluntarily over to law enforcement. And I understand you have a retention issue for how long they could conceivably keep it. But your view is that law enforcement would need to get a warrant to search that information that I voluntarily turned over to law enforcement that they're probably keeping in some database somewhere with that information or in a case file from some investigation. They would need to get a warrant to look at anything related to a prior investigation.
Essentially, yes. And that's where consent is really tethered to the purpose and the object of the search. So in that instance, I would have given consent for, you know, some discussion would have come before me giving consent. You know, what do you want to, why do you want my blood? Do you want to check my alcohol level? You know, what do you want to look at? And so that Jimeno tells us that that limits the scope of consent. Remember, Jimeno involved this officer who suspected the defendant was involved in drug trafficking, pulls him over, says, hey, I think you have narcotics in your car. Can I search your car? And the defendant says, sure. Okay. And lo and behold, in a brown paper bag, they find drugs. The two lower courts said that that wasn't okay, that the scope of consent did not go beyond or allow the police to go into closed containers. And the Supreme Court said, well, we have to look at everything kind of surrounding those circumstances. We have to look at the purpose and the object of the search. And because the object of the search was narcotics, it permitted them to search in anywhere that narcotics could have been found. So in a way, it sort of made the scope a little more expansive, but the rules got to cut both ways. If it can be used to make the scope more expansive, the purpose and the object can also make things more limited. Like in Jimeno, they couldn't have, you know, looked for a refrigerator in that case.
Let me just follow up. So, you know, law enforcement keeps, keeps files for some period of time on investigations that they do. You get a case that comes and you run a search. And obviously we have a situation a little bit like that here. And you pull up a file and you got a police report. And the police report might have a bunch of exhibits on it or something along those lines. So is an officer going to have to sort of like, there might be pieces of that report that you would argue were evidence that were given over that now they would need a warrant to look at. Maybe the law enforcement officer's own interview statements would be fine, you would say. But I'm trying to figure out how this practically works out, right, for law enforcement trying to go back and look at prior files from a prior investigation that is probably a mix of evidence and statements and internal reports and thoughts. And I think your argument means that some of that is permissible, but that law enforcement would need to get a warrant to relook at other stuff that it gathered in the context of that prior investigation, if it's even permitted to keep it at all. It'll have to, you know, probably be a pretty extensive workload to figure out what they need to throw out and what they don't, if you were right about that piece. But am I understanding that correctly, how this would play out?
Well, I mean, it depends. Certainly police reports, I don't have a problem with that. The evidence, it really depends on the nature of the evidence. Is it a ring, like in Betterly, that, you know, someone just looked at? You know, you have, I think you do have a reduced expectation of privacy in the things that police like just actually, you know, see and are exposed to. But when you're talking about doing like an exploratory search, rummaging in things like extractions, blood, DNA evidence, at that point, that's when you need the new warrant, because the probable cause or scope of consent that justified the seizure and the search of that data initially, it doesn't transfer to new crimes. You know, probable cause to think that someone is a drug dealer doesn't give probable cause to believe that that individual is involved in a homicide. And so the final thing that I want to talk about is this issue of harmless error. Okay. I know that the state pointed out that Mr. Birch, I mean, he testified to a lot of this stuff, but the problem is that that illegal search, when they went into that cell phone again, was the venomous tree from which all of the fruits of conviction sprouted. And I think that there is a very legitimate argument for suppression of his testimony. It was not knowing, and it was not voluntary, because it was based on the incorrect premise that police could and did present all of this illegally obtained evidence. And the decision to testify was made after the jury heard all of this illegal evidence. And then finally, I just wanted to make a point about deleted data. That was one of the things in this case that the tech said, well, you know, I had to get everything so I could get at the, you know, deleted text messages. When someone deletes data, I think that that is a manifestation of an expectation of privacy. They don't want to see that data again, and they don't want anyone else to see that data again. So to the extent we're going to allow for deleted data to be obtained by consent, I think that needs to be very specifically consented to. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you. Attorney O'Neill, are you prepared to begin?
I am. Thank you.
Please.
May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill, on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. The Fourth Amendment issue in this case arises from a consent search of data downloaded from the defendant's cell phone. This court's primary task in resolving that issue is to determine whether law enforcement exceeded the scope of the defendant's consent when they examined that data for evidence related to this case when it was retained in a file for an unrelated investigation. Because the defendant consented to allow police to download and search the entire contents of his cell phone without any limitation, the police could retain the extracted data and re-examine it later without violating the Fourth Amendment.
Counselor, can I stop you there? Because I think there was consent to the police department in this case. The consent form was very broad. It gave consent to the search of the Samsung cell phone, but it was given to a particular detective, a particular officer, and any assisting personnel in the police department. So I'm trying to square the Fourth Amendment with that subsequent search and with the Riley case. So, and Douglas, okay? So under Douglas, the police, if I give consent to search my home, they can't keep coming back to my house and saying, well, you gave consent once, you can come back anytime, right? The Riley court said that the search of a cell phone will give the government access to, quote, far more than the most exhaustive search of a house. A phone not only contains in digital form many sensitive records previously found in the home, it also contains a broad array of private information never found in a home in any form, unless the phone is. So how can you reconcile the statements in Riley, which give heightened protections, I think, to cell phone data, given the type and the extent of information about a person's life that typically resides on a phone? How can you square that with your position that there's no Fourth Amendment implication here?
You asked about both Douglas and Riley. I'll start with Riley. Riley does not recognize that cell phones are subject to heightened protections. The holding in Riley is that a police cannot search a cell phone incident to arrest. The court in Riley basically said cell phones are subject to normal Fourth Amendment protections, and that means they can be searched with a warrant or some other exception to the warrant requirements except for search incident to arrest. And so the exception to the warrant requirement we have here is consent, and our position is that the consent is unlimited, and it allowed the police to retain the data and examine it later. Our position on the re-examination of the data.
Can I stop you there? Because I have a follow-up question. So in this case, we're talking about the cell phone of a defendant to a crime. At one point, he was a suspect. But we also received an amicus brief that talks about how victims are asked to consent to giving their cell phone data over to the police for investigatory purposes. So does it comport with Fourth Amendment principles that the police in subsequent investigations where a victim might become a suspect, the police forever on with no limits can go back to all this data of this one-time victim and use it for criminal investigatory purposes?
It's going to depend on the consent that the victim gave. And in most cases, I think the consent that victims give and that the police obtain is going to be limited to what the police are investigating for. We're not saying that in every case where the police retain data extracted from a cell phone, that they can thereafter go in and re-examine it again. Any re-examination is going to be limited to the either the consent or the warrant or whatever basis they had to search the cell phone in the first place.
Well, assume the victim's consent form is what the City of Green Bay Police Department used in this case. It wasn't particularized for a criminal suspect. It's just a consent to search. So assuming that that type of consent is given, does that mean that police for investigatory purposes or the government for any purposes whatsoever can forever go back to that data and search it?
If the consent is unlimited, then the police can retain it and look at it for anything. If it truly is a blanket consent with no limitations, yes, that's our position.
And your position, counsel, is that the way you can get that kind of consent is just to put the form in front of the person, and then it has then the courts don't look at what the actual circumstances were for consent? Because here, even if you argue that it's the whole phone, isn't it just related to this incident and this particular crime that's being investigated?
That's the defendant's argument, but the circuit court here made some findings about what happened. The court found that the initial conversation was related to the text messages related to the hit and run investigation, but that it expanded and the officer and the defendant began discussing the information on the cell phone. The officer then obtained permission to download the contents of the cell phone, and the defendant then signed the consent form allowing a complete search of the phone.
Even if you think that it was somehow expanded, it's still in regard to this investigation. You're saying all of a sudden you think it expanded to the point where, because of that form, that the defendant is saying you can search my phone for any crime, anytime, everything on my phone, my grocery list, my social security number, anything you want, you can use?
The defendant didn't place any limitations on the search of the phone.
Why does the defendant have to do that? Isn't it the state's burden to prove what the scope of consent is? Why would the defendant who's having this conversation in the context of that crime have to put limits on it?
Because it's reasonable to expect a defendant to put limits on the search of the cell phone. People know what's on their cell phone. People know that there's private information on there. People know that they don't want police looking at their private information on there. And if somebody is concerned about that, it's not unreasonable to ask them to say, please don't look at this. I'm only giving you permission to look at these very specific things.
So you would have the burden be on the defendant to show what the scope of the search is?
No, I'm not putting the burden on the defendant. I'm looking at all the circumstances here, and it's saying what a reasonable person would expect when they hand their phone over to the police and the police tell them, we're going to download the information off this phone, and the person, there's no limits discussed, and they sign a consent form saying that police can search this phone. What does a reasonable person expect will happen in that case? I think it's reasonable to expect that the police are going to take all the data and keep it, and maybe keep it in their file and look at it later. I don't think that the person's, by not putting any limits on it, they're not restraining what the police can do with it.
Counsel, I want to take a look at this consent form, and with your argument that because the defendant failed to place limitations, that it is open to anyone and anything in perpetuity. Now, the consent form is to a detective and to a specific officer in the City of Green Bay Police Department or any assisting personnel. The first question, I have a couple of questions about this form. Is it your position then that this consent is extended to any other law enforcement agency in the country or any place?
No, our position is that the subsequent examination by the Brown County Sheriff's Department was not a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. The search happened here when the police extracted the data from the phone, and the data from the phone was extracted by one of the people listed in the consent form.
Now, this is a real blanket consent to search form, because there is, and it's an appendix, page 114, and it says to search my premises, and you can circle that. You can circle my person, my vehicle, my property, or other. And here, other is circled, and that's then written in Samsung cell phone. So with your argument advanced, let's say someone had circled my premises. Does that mean then that they can come back, the law enforcement, any law enforcement, can come back and search the premises? Anytime?
Anytime, no. No, that's not what we're saying. Douglas,
that's what you were saying.
No, that's not what we're saying. When a person can take, when the police obtain consent to, say, search somebody's house, they're allowed to search it once, and we don't dispute that.
Well, who put that limitation on this consent form? I don't see anything about limiting it to one search here. Just a general form. How about if they search your vehicle and they circled vehicle instead? Does that mean anytime that vehicle is stopped, it can be searched in perpetuity?
No, the law limits generally one search per, you know, consent or warrant. But what happened here is not the repeated intrusion into the defendant's cell phone. The defendant consented to have data from his cell phone extracted and to allow police to examine that. That became evidence. That became something the police put in their file. The police couldn't, the analogy, if you're talking about police being able to go search a defendant's house again or search a car again, would be that the defendant could, or that the police could go up to the defendant and then ask to search his phone again to extract the data from it again at a later date. They couldn't do that with this consent form. The consent form allowed them to take the data from the phone on this one instance. And so our position is that the consent allowed them to, you know, retain it and examine it later without any limitations.
Counsel, does consent have to be voluntary in yes. order to be lawful? Does it have to be knowing in order to be lawful?
Yes.
And so it's your position that a reasonable person is, what's the standard? An objectively reasonable person, right? An objectively reasonable person, after the conversation that had taken place in this particular case regarding the text, the initial conversation that the circuit court found to be focused on the text exchange, that an objectively reasonable person would say to law enforcement, you can download anything you want on my computer. Is that what you think an objectively reasonable person would do, since it has to be knowing and voluntary?
That is our position. And I think, again, it's based on the totality of the circumstances. I think a reasonable person understands what it means to, when you agree to let police download your cell phone, understand that they're going to get access to everything that's on there.
So, okay, that's interesting. I mean, since previously the Riley case speaks of how unique a cell phone is, it's almost a misnomer. I mean, it is your life, much more your life and perhaps your friends' lives and your relatives' lives, all in this cell phone. And so you think that in fact, sometimes they say the reasonably objective person is the typical person. So you think the typical person would say to law enforcement, sure, have access to all of this. You think that's what the reasonably typical person would do?
Under the facts of this case, yes. I think that's what they would understand that they're consenting to.
Okay.
Mr. O'Neill, can I ask you to clear up the question that we had earlier about the warrant? I'm looking at footnote number 3 in your brief, which appears on page 21, which tells me that the Brown County Sheriff's Office actually searched Birch's phone twice with a warrant. Where did that warrant come from? Because we have the consent. I just don't understand. There's the Green Bay Department asked for consent. He signed the consent form, and I'm just leaving aside there are any issues with that. Just put that over here. So he signs the consent form. The phone gets turned over. The extraction happens. The Green Bay Police Department holds on to that extraction data. The Brown County Sheriff's Office then retrieves the extraction, and then do they get a warrant? I don't understand.
Sure. Keep in mind the distinction between the extracted data and the cell phone itself. The warrant, the two warrants, and there's only evidence of one of them in the record, and there's not much. The warrants were to search the cell phone when the cell phone was found at the time of the defendant's arrest. The phone was found, my understanding, it was found in his house when the police arrested him, and it was seized then. And it was then searched with a warrant, I believe, relatively quickly after that. And then it was searched again with a second warrant closer in time to the trial. I actually believe it was after the suppression hearing, but again, none of this is in the record. So there were warrant searches of the cell phone itself, not of the data that was retained in the files of the Green Bay Police Department.
And then to get the information from Google, was there a subpoena? There must have been.
There was a search warrant to Google with the email address. That is in the record. The law enforcement submitted a search warrant to Google, and Google provided the data in response to that.
Counsel, let's look what's in the record and not in the record. I noted that the circuit court talked about search incident to an arrest, not with regard to warrant. Am I correct?
Yeah, the court did mention that. It's
decision. Yeah, the court didn't say there was a warrant. The circuit court said that the search was incident to arrest. Is there a warrant in any appendix here?
No, it was not made part of the record. The only reference to the first search warrant that was conducted on the cell phone itself, the cell phone when it was found when the defendant was arrested, is to a hearing that is after the suppression hearing, or at least a testimonial part of the suppression hearing.
Yeah, I think I have that right here. This is it. Record 251:73. What do you do in order to obtain data from Google for location purposes? Question. Answer. A warrant or a subpoena would have to be written to Google's corporation requesting that data. Question. And was that done in this case? Answer. Yes, it was. So we don't know if it was a warrant or a subpoena there. I note that the Court of Appeals says it was a subpoena. Do you contest that?
My recollection from the record is that it was a search warrant, not a subpoena.
Okay, let's take the only other reference that I see in the record, and that's 246:95 and 96. Question. And why was that significant to you? Answer. Information that I had through recent trainings and recent conversations with coworkers is that Google has this thing called Google Dashboard that is associated with your email account, which will track your locations based upon GPS. Question. And ultimately, did you draft a subpoena for those records? Answer. I did not personally. I directed or worked with Sergeant Lapno to do that. He took the information that we had based off that download, and he completed a search warrant for those results. I interpret the question and answer being that I don't know if it's a subpoena or a warrant because he's answered yes to both.
Correct.
Show me proof that it was a warrant, since circuit court says it was search incident to arrest. The Court of Appeals says subpoena. So as your opposing counsel says in brief,
What warrant? Where's the warrant?
Well, we're talking about two different things here, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
Search,
tell me.
The search to the request to Google for the data based on the defendant's email address, and I'm fairly certain that it was a search warrant and not a subpoena. That was introduced as an exhibit at the suppression hearing, I believe, so that's easily determinable. But that was a warrant based on information extracted from the phone based on what finding the defendant's email address. The search incident to arrest issue was, and I think the court misspoke. I don't think, you know, there's some testimony that uses the phrase search incident to arrest, but it's not really developed well in the record. But that was in terms of, that was related to finding the phone in the defendant's possession when he was arrested for this crime. It has nothing to do with the extraction of the data originally that was placed in the files of the Green Bay Police Department.
So the I'm finished.
I was just going to clarify here. You're not trying to argue to us that it's you can search a phone incident to someone's arrest.
No, absolutely not. Riley prohibits that. And if there wasn't, I want to point out in the record that when the phone was found in the defendant's possession, the record at least references one search that was conducted of the phone with the warrant. And that's at record 235, pages 3 and 4. The state mentions that the phone was found in his possession and police then subsequently searched it with a warrant. That phone, from, you know, an analytical perspective, is not the same phone that police had retained in the data in their file, because assuming that the defendant used it subsequent to when the police, the phone was returned to the defendant after it was extracted. So the defendant presumably used it after that, and it would be at that point when the police found it, you know, 2 months later after they returned it, it would contain different data. So the police, when they found that phone, though, they searched it with a search warrant. And again, my understanding is that it was searched again later in the process, again with a search warrant.
Counsel, how do you respond to the question that I asked opposing counsel about the email address and the privacy interest in it, if that's the case? How does that factor in?
That's not something that we briefed. I understand what you're saying. This is something that's voluntarily shared with presumably a lot of people. And I think there could be an argument that the defendant doesn't have a privacy interest here, but, you know, we haven't made that argument. We've assumed that the police had no other way, at least they didn't find out any other way about the defendant's email address other than looking at the phone data.
Are you asking us to remand this case and tell us why?
We're asking to remand this case to address the independent source doctrine, and we're asking this court to do that based on the two subsequent warrants that were conducted of the defendant's searches pursuant to warrants that were conducted of the defendant's cell phone. The record, as I said, only references one of the warrants. It doesn't have the warrant itself. It doesn't have what was found in the search that was conducted to the warrant. And there's nothing about the second search in the record. But if the police found the phone in the defendant's possession when he was arrested, or found it related to his arrest, I think it might have been in his apartment rather than on his person, and they obtained a search warrant to search it then, that would provide, and assuming they found, again, the same internet history and found the defendant's email, that would be a completely independent source for that information that was unrelated to any potential Fourth Amendment violation that was committed by going back to re-examine the data that was in the possession of the of the Green Bay Police Department.
Would you address the good faith argument too? And I don't think you're asking us to remand if the court wished to go that route, but would you address that, please?
Sure. Our good faith argument, and I think it can be resolved on the record, that our argument is that suppressing the evidence here wouldn't further the purposes of the exclusionary rule, because when the Brown County Sheriff's Office went into their computer and was able to determine that the police department had had this contact with the defendant, and then they discovered that he had consented, and they found the police reports, and I believe the consent form indicating that he had authorized a search of his phone, I think under those circumstances, it was reasonable for the Brown County Sheriff's Department to conclude that he had consented to a full search of their phone. And if that information was still on file, they had the authority to go and look at it, and it wasn't a Fourth Amendment event. You know, there's nothing in the record that suggests that the police department recklessly or deliberately omitted any information from the reports about the defendant's scope of consent. And as the, I think, testimony at the suppression hearing established, sharing information between law enforcement agencies is a routine practice, especially when, as is the case here, we have overlapping jurisdictions. And we want police to share information when they're investigating cases. And finally, the last piece of the good faith argument is that when the Brown County Sheriff's Department went and looked at this retained data, they were relying on established case law that, you know, it's discussed in my brief, especially the Federley case that says when law enforcement wants to take another look at something that they already lawfully have in their possession, they can do it to the extent that they are allowed to look at it originally. And here, because it was at least reasonable for the sheriff's office to believe that there was unlimited consent to examine that data, it was reasonable for them to think that they could go in and look at it and then find what they did.
Mr. O'Neill, can you respond to the question? No, I can't remember which one of my colleagues asked it, but I think it was Justice Hagedorn, regarding the brief from Legal Action of Wisconsin, or maybe it was Justice Bradley, whoever it was, I'm sorry. It was you, Justice Bradley. Okay. Want to attribute it the right place. So Justice Bradley talked about the amicus brief, and Attorney Babcock, you know, came right out, talking about, so holding up a thumb drive and saying, I have these, I have thousands of them from files that include really, really intimate information about victims. It's hard not to hear that. It's hard for me to hear that anyhow. I'll speak for myself without the hair on the back of my neck sticking up. Can you respond to both the brief that was filed and then the emphasis that Attorney Babcock put on that?
I share your concerns. I think that the amicus brief validly points out that we don't want victims' information, you know, being you know, willy-nilly open to view from, you know, defendants or the public or anything like that. But you know, I hope in most of these cases that law enforcement's going to be sensitive and, you know, restrain themselves to looking for the information that's relevant to their investigation. Again, victims can place limits on what the police can do. They can say, you can't look at everything on my phone. You can only look at the things that I'm going to let you look at.
The problem with that, of course, is as soon as a victim puts up any barrier with law enforcement, that can start to be an issue, right? And so, you know, victims, you know, if they want an investigation to be completed, most feel like they need to cooperate as much as possible in order to, for a complete investigation to be conducted.
That's fair. And all I can say really is in every case, it's going to depend on what happened in that case. A rule, you know, prohibiting retention or prohibiting, you know, or really focusing on making consent super, super narrow in these cases, it could have, you know, sort of dramatic effects down the road that we can't anticipate. And, when counsel held up the thumb drive with everyone's cell phone on it, I didn't realize that there was, you know, that significant amount of data in this case. I only have access to the appellate record that you do. But I will note that in this case, one of those victims' personal data from his cell phone was used by the defendant. The victim's boyfriend, who was originally accused of the murder, his phone was extracted with his consent, and the defendant used data just extracted from that phone, specifically text messages between him and the victim, in his defense. This rule that the defendant's proposing is going to cut both ways. It's going to limit, at least in this case, it could have limited evidence that the defendant ultimately used to try to prove his innocence.
So counsel, just to follow up on that, is the argument you're making here based entirely on sort of the scope of consent that is presented with regard to this information in terms of whether there's other, any other constitutional lines here? And if so, what if the court has some problems with the scope of consent? How does that affect your argument on this in retention and the subsequent search?
If our argument depends pretty much entirely on the scope of the consent. If the defendant didn't agree to, if the defendant only agreed to let the police look at the text messages that were related to the hit and run, then that they exceeded the scope of his consent. I don't think that this court even has to get into the retention issue or whether they could download the entire phone issue, because even if those were permissible, the police could not then go back and look at the retained data without a warrant if his consent was indeed limited in the way that he's claiming that it was.
Unless good faith, absolutely.
But I'm saying in terms of finding a Fourth Amendment violation, it does depend largely on the scope of his consent. And just one last thing, I'd like to urge this court not to even reach the retention issue here. And that's because it's forfeited. The defendant did not raise this claim in the circuit court. The defendant took a contrary position in the circuit court, and that position is that that the police could have searched the retained data with a warrant. And now the defendant is arguing that that data shouldn't have been here in the first place for the police to look at. Under the circumstances, we don't have a decision from the circuit court to review on this retention issue. I think there's some missing information in the record. The record wasn't developed. I know counsel has sort of backed off her, has withdrawn her argument about closing the investigation as being relevant to the retention issue, but there really is no information about in the record about when this investigation was closed. There's no development of anything about what it even means to close an investigation. So I ask this court not reach the issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Attorney Babcock, rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Excuse me. At first, I would like to just put to bed this elusive warrant that may or may not exist. As I understand it, that warrant was issued after the time of arrest. But again, they only got to arrest after they got the Gmail account, which got the Google dashboard data, which served as probable cause to arrest. So you can't, you can't use illegally obtained data and then use that as a basis for a warrant. So I don't think the court needs to do anything with that. Now, I wanted to get back to Justice Hagedorn's concerns about like the second search and my proposed rule for a warrant. I do acknowledge that when it comes to physical evidence, you know, that may be a little difficult to apply. But this case is about cell phones, and the court can limit that rule just to cell phones. If police want to go and search an extraction for a crime unrelated to the initial purpose of that, they must get a warrant. And I do take issue with the way that my friend on the other side posed when the search happened. He said the search happened when the phone was extracted. I don't know that that's necessarily true, because as I understand it, I don't think that the tech actually like looked at any of the data. She just transferred it over and then took the relevant categories and parsed them out. I definitely think that there was a seizure of the data at that point, but I don't know that it necessarily implicated any additional Fourth Amendment concerns. But when there was that new search, that is the point at which the Fourth Amendment was absolutely triggered.
Well, can we get to the same place that you're asking us to get to by focusing on consent? And when it comes to a cell phone, that it needs to be specific. I mean, it's already the law in general, but specifically with regard to a cell phone, because there's so much information and it is so broad, that it needs to be the specific consent that's given and not the default to everything.
You're right. Yeah, absolutely. The law is clear on that already. The court said that in Reed. It has to be specific. The only additional thing I'm asking this court is to adopt the rule in Lemons that these general consent forms are of, you know, little assistance in evaluating actual consent, and that police can't assure a defendant or a victim that, yeah, we're just going to look at your text messages, sign this form, there's the bait and switch, right? That shouldn't, the specificity requirement doesn't get you from point A to point B with that type of bait and switch situation.
Counsel, with you, I know your time is short. I have just a quick question. I'd like you to hear your response on the good faith argument here. You've got, a second law enforcement agency who might presume that the information that another law enforcement agency is holding is lawfully there, and therefore accessing that information. Why would good faith not apply to that second search?
Because the there was no, legal basis for them to go in and do that. I mean, even in Ganias, law enforcement knew well enough to go and get a second warrant, and that sort of cured the problem. McCavitt, law enforcement got a warrant too. And even in that case, they said it's not good faith. The good faith exception applies. You know, there's all these nice sound bites about we only do it, you know, in the most serious of cases to deter police misconduct. But the rule is, did the police rely on well-settled law? And there's no case law out there that sanctioned this search. Now, as Justice Bradley, Rebecca Bradley pointed out, cell phones do get heightened protection. And that is from that quote that Justice Bradley read from the Riley decision. Other courts have interpreted that to mean that cell phones get about the same protection as a house and maybe even more. That's, you know, if the phone is found inside the house. So I think even if the court rules against me on consent and retention, this new search, Chief Justice Roberts, in the unanimous decision in Riley, made clear what has to happen. At page 403, get a warrant. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And thank you both for a case that was well briefed and well argued. The court is now going to adjourn. We will meet in closed conference at 3:00, and we will begin our conference with this case. We are adjourned.